Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich.
100,000 people were killed by the atomic bomb, and these six were among the survivors. They still wonder why they lived when so many others died. Each of them counts many small items of chance or volition, a step taken in time, a decision to go indoors, catching one streetcar instead of the next that spared him. And now each knows that in the act of survival, he lived a dozen lives and saw more death than he ever thought he would see. At the time, none of them knew anything.
That's the late great actress Ruby Dee reading an excerpt from John Hersey's classic book, Hiroshima. Today marks the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima that occurred on August the 6th, 1945. 3 days later, the United States also dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki. Less than a year after that, American writer John Hersey traveled to Hiroshima to interview survivors of the bombing. His humanistic portrayal of six people, a widowed seamstress, a minister, a young woman who worked in a factory, a German Jesuit priest, and two doctors, became a three-part series in the New Yorker magazine and then later turned into the book Hiroshima. And it immediately challenged the prevailing narrative of the time that the atomic attacks on the Japanese cities were morally justified. To mark the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, today we present a conversation that we had about the book with scholar Patrick B. Sharp. And we will also be sprinkling in excerpts of this radio presentation of the book that was recorded in 2004 by the Pacifica Radio Archives. Now, just a moment ago, we heard from Ruby Dee, and before we get to today's conversation, here's Ruby Dee's late husband and great actor himself, Ozzie Davis, also reading from Hiroshima.
Dr. Fuji sat down cross-legged in his underwear on the spotless matting of the porch, put on his glasses, and started reading the Osaka Asabi. He liked to read the Osaka news because his wife was there. He saw the flash. To him, faced away from the center and looking at his paper, it seemed a brilliant yellow. Startled, he began to rise to his feet. In that moment, he was 1,551 yards from the center. The hospital leaned behind his rising and, with a terrible ripping noise, toppled into the river. The doctor, still in the act of getting to his feet, was thrown forward and around and over. He was buffeted and gripped. He lost track of everything because things were so speeded up. He felt the water. Dr. Fuji hardly had time to think that he was dying before he realized that he was alive.
Again, Ozzie Davis from 2004, reading John Hersey's book, Hiroshima. He and Ruby Dee were just two of many actors who participated in the Pacifica Radio Archives radio reading of the book. And marking the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, today we'll hear more from that production as we also bring you a conversation that I had with Patrick B. Sharp on the significance of John Hersey's book. Patrick B. Sharp is professor and chair of liberal studies at California State University, Los Angeles, and he has written extensively on the book Hiroshima. We first conducted this interview on the 70th anniversary of the nuclear attack. Patrick B. Sharp, it's my good pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Thank you for having me.
John Hersey's book Hiroshima would be published more or less 2 years after the nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Talk to me about what the narrative was in this country between the actual attacks and before the emergence of the story that John Hersey told. How was it talked about here?
Well, a lot of the narrative of the atomic bombing was coming from the military, which especially during the occupation of Japan in the early days, was heavily censored and was heavily geared towards military objectives. The narrative as it emerged initially from the press actually came from William Lawrence, a journalist who was brought on to the Manhattan Project to serve as the official journalist of the Manhattan Project. He actually went on the Nagasaki mission as an observer. And he wrote a lot of the narratives about that were originally released to the public.
Didn't he write the first press release in which Harry Truman announced that such a bomb was dropped?
Yeah, he wrote the first draft of it. A few things were changed from it, but he wrote the first draft of that as well, yes. And so the narrative really emphasized a lot of the sublime elements of the explosions of the great power, but there was the narrative of the blinding flash, the fireball, the shockwave, and then the mushroom cloud. That really began to become the narrative sequence of events in talking about the explosion. But that was a narrative of events that is, of course, from the perspective of people who were dropping the bomb or were a safe distance from it, observing it from a distance. And so one of the things to note about the perspectives, which, as you might expect, were that the narratives, the stories being told in the press, the ways in which they were discussed in the by the military was from the perspective of people who had done the dropping of the bomb and who are witnessing the effects from a great distance, not on the ground.
In John Hersey's Hiroshima, he only says, what, mushroom cloud once through the entire book.
Yes, he uses a local dust cloud. It was very difficult. You could not see the mushroom cloud from the perspective of the people whose stories he was telling. So, he intentionally left out that reference for most of the book just to emphasize the perspective of the people who are underneath the bombing.
And again, that is important in understanding what his book, Hiroshima, meant to the discussion and the narrative of the day about these bombings is this is the real first piece of literature, of writings, at least in English, that had the perspective of the people who actually were the victims of this bombing.
Yes, the Strategic Bombing Survey of the United States had actually released a report that had began to try to talk a little bit about radiation sickness and lingering illness, because that was one of the things that began to be understood as one of the unique effects of the bomb. The initial description of the atomic bomb just basically described it as a large conventional weapon that caused extensive damage, but was no different from any of the other bombs or fire bombs that we had dropped on Japan already. And in fact, some reporting actually implied that it was less destructive than, for example, the firebombing of Tokyo. So the discussions of radiation sickness that were coming out of official channels, while they were trying to address the effects of radiation on the body, were still detached clinical accounts. And when you have people like Philip Morrison, wrote an account in One World or None, which came out a few months before Hiroshima, imagining what the bombing would be like if it was dropped, if an atomic bomb was dropped on New York City, and tried to imagine for Americans what that would mean for us as Americans. But it still did not give specific detailed accounts of people as individuals, as an individual story of people who are civilians. Not sort of the Shinto fanatics that the Japanese had been represented as in war propaganda up to that point.
There wasn't much of a debate before John Hersey's book about the moral ethics of dropping such a bomb in this country.
There was a little bit of a debate about it, but largely it was muted. Surveys of the day showed overwhelming popularity and overwhelming sentiment in favor of the bombings. There was a strong sense that it had saved a great deal of American lives because it prevented the invasion, the land invasion of Japan. And so there was that general, post-war euphoria that Japan had been conquered. But it wasn't until you start to get these stories coming out of Japan that were largely discredited, but were still being printed about radiation sickness or mysterious illnesses killing people long after the war had ended. And that's when, over time, the narrative began to change, or at least public sentiment began to open up to the fact that maybe the atomic bomb was actually unethical in some basic way that the initial euphoria had sort of not allowed the people to consider.
as she dressed on the morning of August 20th in the home of her sister-in-law in Kabe, not far from Nagatsuka. Mrs. Nakamura, who had suffered no cuts or burns at all, though she had been rather nauseated all through the week she and her children had spent as guests of Father Kleinsorge and the other Catholics at the novitiate, began fixing her hair and noticed, after one stroke, that her comb carried with it a whole handful of hair. The second time, the same thing happened. So she stopped combing at once. But in the next 3 or 4 days, her hair began falling out of its own accord, until she was quite bald. She began living indoors, practically in hiding. On August 26th, both she and her younger daughter, Mieko, woke up feeling extremely weak and tired, and they stayed on their bedrolls. Her son and other daughter, who had shared every experience with her during and after the bombing, felt fine.
Again, a reading from Pacifica Radio Archives audio recording of John Hersey's book, Hiroshima. Patrick Sharp, talk to me more about how people learned about radiation sickness, that also began to change the conversation here.
One of the things to note is that radiation sickness, the Manhattan Project, especially General Leslie Groves, the military head of the Manhattan Project, began to try to refute accounts of radiation sickness and the severity of them. He testified before Congress that it was a relatively pleasant way to die. He commented that he and other military commentators characterized this as a hysteria of sympathy for radiation sickness and really undercut it narratively to make it seem like it was irrational. But one of the reasons why it was why it really began to get traction was, first of all, because these stories were true, and secondly, because it really did begin to affect the sense that we were killing civilians after hostilities had ceased. So while the war fervor was still fresh, these stories didn't get as much traction, but they continued to go on. And when Hersey published his story, which he did not submit for military censorship, it really broke the story for the first time in a way to show how truly horrific radiation sickness was, how long after the bombings, some of the symptoms and manifestations of the illness began to show up and began to really make people question what this new weapon was that we had used that was killing civilians long after, long after the war had ended.
And again, the public discourse over the bombing before Hersey's book and before news about radiation sickness hit in had almost of a kind of a gee-wow essence of it in science.
Yes, it was, it was the atomic bomb, right? That was the term that came from an H.G. Wells novel, The World Set Free. In 1914, he had imagined this type of exchange of atomic bombs, and it had become really common in science fiction and pop culture. You got all these different atomic energy weapons of various sorts and radium guns and things of this sort coming from science fiction, stuff like Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, those types of popular science fiction narratives. But one of the things in these narratives is that this sort of yellow peril discourse, this idea that Asians were inherently a threat to the United States, was well entrenched in the popular imagination before World War II, and particularly in science fiction, it was common. I mean, Flash Gordon fought Ming the Merciless, the Buck Rogers fought the Emperor and the Mongol invaders from Asia.
Because in Buck Rogers, the Mongols invaded the United States.
Yes, that is correct. And so you get this fear of Asian invaders into the United States, stories that go back to Jack London at the beginning of the century, in fact, and other authors. And then when Pearl Harbor happened, it was seen by many as a fulfillment of the prophecy that Jack London and others had made. And then when you get the beginning of a war that seems like something that comes straight out of pulp fiction, and then a conclusion to the war that is straight out of science fiction, literally straight out of science fiction, it really began to get people to think about Well, first of all, they lived in a science fiction world now. And secondly, there was a definite gee whiz, wow, isn't this powerful? Isn't it kind of cool and awesome sort of sentiment, at least among some members of the general population, that this was a wonderful new weapon, that it saved lives, and that showed Americans' military might, and it actually fulfilled the narrative structure that existed in a lot of these stories where the European Americans, the white protagonists, out-invent the Asians, and that's what causes an end to the science fiction narrative, is the great inventive prowess of Europeans and European Americans.
John Hersey wrote this, quote, "Even if the survivors had known the truth, most of them were too busy or too wary or too badly hurt to care that they were the objects of the first great experiment and the use of atomic power." Hersey's very clear where he's coming from in this book.
He is very clear. And this was, you know, in the post-World War II moment, when we're starting to think about the atrocities of the Nazis, the atrocities of the Japanese in relationship to conducting experiments on humans. The in vivo experiments of Nazi doctors are, of course, notorious. The Nuremberg trials were very, very much a part of a manifestation of these concerns in the post-war years and debates about the morality of the war. The Nazis were seen as clearly immoral once we learned all of the things that had been going on in the death camps. The Japanese were clearly seen as immoral once we understood all of the things that were happening in the prisoner of war camps. So as these stories of their atrocities were coming out and being better understood after the war, the fact that Hersey chooses this language to point out that the Japanese civilians were being used as subjects of an experiment, a science experiment by the United States. Well, that was very loaded language that was directly aimed at the ongoing moral debate about science and that particular post-war moment.
Here's more what John Hersey wrote in Hiroshima.
"Some of us consider the bomb in the same category as poison gas and were against its use on a civilian population. Others were of the opinion that in total war, as carried on in Japan, there was no difference between civilians and soldiers, and that the bomb itself was an effective force tending to end the bloodshed, warning Japan to surrender, and thus to avoid total destruction. It seems logical that he who supports total war in principle cannot complain of a war against civilians. The crux of the matter is whether total war in its present form is justifiable, even when it serves a just purpose. Does it not have material and spiritual evil as its consequences, which far exceed whatever good might result?"
This is Letters in Politics, and today we are marking the 75th anniversary of the United States atomic attack against Hiroshima. And we're doing it through the story of John Hersey's book, also named Hiroshima. We are presenting today a conversation that I had with Patrick B. Sharp, who is now professor and chair of liberal studies at California State University, Los Angeles. He has written extensively on the book Hiroshima, and he also teaches it in class. Patrick Sharp, tell me more about how American writer Jack London fits into the story of the portrayal of the Japanese.
Jack London wrote a couple of stories. I mean, he did reporting on the Russo-Japanese War from the front lines in 1904, 1905. He traveled with the Japanese as an observer, entrenched with the Japanese military, writing stories that he sent back to his editors. And in these, he began to construct his Yellow Peril narratives about the dangers that a modern militarized Japan posed for the United States. And in particular, he emphasized that this is a racial threat. He characterized the Japanese, who he saw as racially inferior, as somehow a strange mutation. He used the language of mutation of the day. He saw them as somebody who, a race that was able to translate science and technology, which he saw as inherently the product of European minds and technological might, and translate it in a way that would mobilize Asia. And so he saw them as particularly a racial threat because they were the supposedly inferior race that was able to master technology and put it to barbaric uses that were a direct threat to white America. So he wrote a story called The Unparalleled Invasion, which was a fictionalized version of this, where Japan mobilizes China and together they begin to invade the world, largely using immigration as a weapon. And the only way in which the white nations of the world are able to survive is by having a scientist invent biological warfare and exterminating all of the Asians through biological warfare. And so that was a story he wrote and published in 1910 that was a widely distributed story. And so that type of narrative of race war with an apocalyptic ending that really did not value the life of Asians was, again, something that in World War II, a lot of people looked back to Jack London as the visionary who predicted a lot of this. And so there's a lot of narrative echoes of this in the post-war period with thinking about the science fictional echoes of these stories like Jack London, like Buck Rogers, like Flash Gordon, and how these types of science fictional narratives were used to make sense out of a weapon that was named after a science fictional weapon.
Getting back to John Hersey, he was... Yeah. Born in China, to missionary parents. His first language, I read, was Chinese. So he had already, as an older, as somebody who grew up, more of a global perspective than probably most Americans at that time did. What else do you think is important to know about John Hersey in telling the story about Hiroshima in his book?
Well, he had written A Bell for Adano in 1944, which was about an Italian story that was really trying to resuscitate in some ways the image of the Italians after they had been defeated in the war. And so he really had already established himself as a first-rate writer who was actually willing to look at people who were recently our enemies in a friendly light. And so he had. He was also, another thing to know about him was that he was a student who had studied English literature. He understood very clearly what he was doing with the imagery that he used in Hersey's Hiroshima. And so one of the things that I argue in my publications is that he took the language of literary modernism, but specifically the wasteland imagery of literary modernism, and used it to tell a nonfiction story. So in other words, he took the image of the wasteland about nature being broken and out of balance, about water that kills instead of bringing life, about dust that rains down and is a sign of death. He used this language as a way to actually explain what had actually happened, and the procession of the wounded become this sort of procession of the damned, of the sort that we see in T.S. Eliot's famous poem. And that actually really became the way of thinking about the nuclear wasteland or the apocalyptic wasteland that just became so so common in the post-World War II period when thinking about future wars, when thinking about nuclear disaster, or later on in thinking about environmental disaster. Rachel Carson with Silent Spring took this language of nuclear apocalypse and the nuclear wasteland and translated that into thinking about ecological disasters and ecological wastelands. So in a narrative sense, we still live with the legacy of John Hersey's Hiroshima and thinking about how nuclear sites or how environmentally damaged locations are wastelands of a particular sort. He's the person who really took that fictional type of imagery and really made it non-fictional in a way that was very powerful.
The morning, again, was hot. Father Kleinsorger went to fetch water for the wounded in a bottle and a teapot he had borrowed. He had heard that it was possible to get fresh tap water outside Asano Park. Outside the gate of the park, Father Kleinsorger found a faucet that still worked, part of the plumbing of a vanished house, and he filled his vessels and returned.
When he had given the wounded the water, he made a second trip. On his way back with the water, he got lost on a detour around a fallen tree. And as he looked for his way through the woods, he heard a voice ask from the underbrush.
Have you anything to drink?
He saw a uniform. Thinking there was just one soldier, he approached with the water. When he had penetrated the bushes, he saw there were about 20 men. And they were all in exactly the same nightmarish state. Their faces were wholly burned. Their eye sockets were hollow. The fluid from their melted eyes had run down their cheeks. They must have had their faces upturned when the bomb went off. Perhaps they were anti-aircraft personnel. Their mouths were mere swollen, pus-covered wounds, which they could not bear to stretch enough to admit the spout of the teapot. So Father Kleinsorger got a large piece of grass and drew out the stem so as to make a straw, and gave them all water to drink that way. One of them said,
I can't see anything.
Father Kleinsorger answered as cheerfully as he could.
Was his book, Hiroshima, pure journalism? Traditional journalism?
In what sense?
Just the facts?
Just the facts. Well, I think that he used literary techniques to make the facts more engaging. He used the story from Thornton Wilder's The Bridge of San Luis Rey, which was, he used that structure, that was a clear influence that he discussed about how to tell the story of a disaster, you tell the story of people who experience the disaster as a part of their everyday life and how it shapes their everyday lives. And that is a true story, but it is a story that gives you a new perspective and a new understanding of the events. And so with Hiroshima, the language and the stories have been so much from the perspective of the bombers or from the perspective of the damage to buildings and the number of casualties. He wanted to actually tell the story of people, of individuals, and how individuals experience this story in a new way. And so in that sense, it probably did not count as traditional journalism, but it was very effective. And as you know, it was voted the most important story of the most important news story of the 20th century. At the end of the 20th century.
And I guess the New Yorker, when it, in three editions, published the story, it took out all of its cartoons.
Yeah, you know, when I've got it sitting right here in front of me. And, you know, one of the things in grad school, when I went and got my hands on the original, that was the first thing that struck me. Because, you know, they've got all this sort of lighthearted stuff throughout the New Yorker, this sort of sense of jocularity. And no, it was nothing like that in there. It's just some vague graphics, but, you know, nothing else. Right. And they had an introductory blurb by the editors, and it just said, the New Yorker this week devotes its entire editorial space to an article on the almost complete obliteration of a city by one atomic bomb and what happened to the people of that city. It does so in the conviction that few of us have yet to comprehend all but incredible destructive power of this weapon, and that everyone might well take time to consider the terrible implications of its use. So they give an editorial blurb that basically explains why the whole issue is just that. Right. So they really understood very clearly the historical importance of what they were doing, and so and the seriousness of it. So they really changed their tone of the whole magazine for that one issue, which is, you know, it's pretty. It takes a lot of guts to do something like that, I think.
Neat that you have a copy of that.
Well, there's a copy of it at the UCLA Library, and I used this thing called a photocopier when I was in grad school. You know, back in the day when we had to do things like that, when it wasn't all online. But I got my hands on an original copy of it in their journal section back when they had paper journals. They probably still have a copy somewhere, but I photocopied the whole version of it. And when I write about it and the things that I write about, I actually cite the original before he added that sort of addendum in 1985, I think it was, and some of those other. I don't think they changed much. I went through and checked. They didn't change anything that I could see with the originals when they reprinted it in the 80s. They just added that extra conclusion. But
anything? What was the extra conclusion about?
The conclusion was really following up with the people 40 years afterward, the aftermath, and that itself sparked a debate amongst people who've been arguing about this for 40 years. But a lot of it was about how, you know, it was about the Hibakusha, the people, I can't say that correctly, I'm sure, but the Hibakusha, the people who were atomic bomb victims, and how they were socially ostracized and had lingering, what we would now call some sort of chronic fatigue syndrome, how they had ongoing struggles in their lives, how those who recovered from radiation sickness were unable to marry or had a very difficult time finding partners because of the sense that they were tainted by the atomic bomb in some basic way. And so it really became about their social ostracization, but also about how they had forgiven the Americans and how, you know, it was basically a kind of a reconciliation kind of chapter. But it's very interesting reading. But, you know, when I teach it, I always tell my students, don't read that. Just read the first four, because I want to talk about what was going on in 1946 during, you know, at that particular moment in history.
How is his book received?
His book was received with, well, it was very mixed to some extent, but it was popular. Let's just say it was reprinted. It was read on the radio over several nights. Newspapers reprinted it in its entirety. It came out as a book, and it remained in print continuously to the present day. There aren't a lot of books that you could say that about. It became required reading for generations of high school students in thinking about the Cold War, especially during the Cold War. I and everyone in my age group, we all read Hiroshima in high school as a part of thinking about what atomic warfare is, what nuclear warfare is, what is at stake in the Cold War. So it really became a touchstone for thinking about the Cold War and war in the late 20th century. What kind of apocalyptic future could be in store for us if we do not find better ways to resolve our conflicts?
Yeah, I remember reading it in high school too, and it sparked the debate that we had in class about whether or not the dropping of the atomic bomb was justified.
Yes, that was an ongoing debate. I mean, it still is an ongoing debate for some people, but whether or not it was justified, one of the things that I always emphasize is that Hersey's novel taught us, his story taught us exactly what was at stake. Whether it was morally justified or not, he showed us how horrible it was and showed us that if we were to use atomic weapons again, well, this was the smallest nuclear weapon it was possible to make. So anything that he describes in Hiroshima is going to be magnified by many orders of magnitude with the weapons we now have. So magnify the horror of that story by many orders of magnitude. And that's what we would have to deal with if there wasn't the use of a nuclear weapon of any sort in the modern world.
Again, John Hersey went to Japan in 1946, conducted his own research, interviewed people. He outlines the stories, or he tells the stories, of six people in the book. Again, a German Jesuit priest, a widowed seamstress, a minister, a young woman who worked in a factory, and two doctors. Do we know why it was those six people?
Well, Hersey talks about it in terms of they were just people who had the most compelling stories. Part of my theory on this is that he chose them also because they represented civilian casualties, and they went against the stereotype of the Japanese as this sort of militarized, fanatical Shinto horde. So there was this rhetoric that there was no such thing as a Japanese civilian, that all Japanese were military combatants, that in this state that they had, there were no innocents, in other words. And that was a very common rhetoric in newspapers and stories during World War II. And so he chose a war widow. He chose two Christian clergymen. He chose a young single woman who worked in a war factory. He chose two doctors in order to show civilians, people who were not combatants in any way, shape, or form, who were affected by this attack. One of the reasons he chose one of the doctors was to show how the hospitals and the medical infrastructure of the cities were overwhelmed by the bombing. And so it sort of magnified the sense of horror. But again, he also showed two Christian clergymen to show, again, this sort of sense that they are not that different from people that we are familiar with in the United States. You know, they're like our neighbors in many ways, to sort of create a sense of familiarity.
A year after the bomb was dropped,
Miss Sasaki was a cripple. Mrs. Nakamura was destitute.
Father Kleinsorge was back in the hospital.
Dr. Sasaki was not capable of the work he once could do.
Dr. Fuji had lost the 30-room hospital it took him many years to acquire and had no prospects of rebuilding it.
Mr. Tanimoto's church had been ruined, and he no longer had his exceptional vitality.
The lives of these six people, who were among the luckiest in Hiroshima, would never be the same.
And finally, did he ever get any blowback from the United States government for his telling of the story?
Not that I'm aware of. I know that the military establishment was not particularly happy with this. I know that in the rhetoric that they used, especially throughout the 40s and the 1950s, one of the things that that they regularly referenced was in their civil defense literature was, if the residents of Hiroshima had known what we know now and followed our civil defense procedures, they would have had far fewer casualties, right? So they seem to be aware that Hersey's story was widely distributed and was very critical of what the military had done. And their, especially their civil defense and then their future war planning, where they would tell these future war stories that would get published in things like Life magazine, they very clearly are responding to Hersey's story in these roundabout ways, providing these critiques of it in some ways, not direct, rather oblique, but really they had to account for Hersey's story. They could no longer ignore the story once it had come out.
Patrick B. Sharp, thank you so much.
Thank you.